Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
Welcome to Chip Chat. It's September 10th. We are live from the Intel Developer Forum on the showcase floor. My name is Allison Klein, the host of Chip Chat. If you attended Renee James' keynote this morning, you probably heard about personalized medicine and a collaboration that Intel is running with the Oregon Health Science University. I don't think there was a person in the house that wasn't impressed with the story of what the scientists at OHSU were driving, and I'm delighted to have Paul Spelling from OHSU with me to tell me more about this collaboration. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Allison.
So personalized medicine, put in perspective what this means from a standpoint of the technology and medical innovation that is coming to a confluence around this topic.
So the challenge for medicine historically has been that we are treated as an average, that we examine how most people respond and we treat them all as the way that most people respond best. And what we've learned is that sometimes treating the people the way most people respond best is the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a number of cases, and we're learning how many there are, where we need to treat everyone individually or break them into distinct groups where different groups of individuals get different treatments and have different and have the right outcome, you know, being well. And so my focus, as well as that for most of the Knight Cancer Institute, is on treating cancer, which is a genetic disease and for which we believe every individual experiences a unique tumor development, and there are probably a very large number of appropriate treatments to have the right outcome of healing and wellness for each individual.
What is it that designates a particular issue that would make it more appropriate for personalized treatment?
So there's a number of possibilities. There are things that we call germline variation, which is differences among people in the DNA that they inherited from their parents, and that changes the way their overall body processes the world, their environment. So for example, there are patients who, if you give them a drug, will metabolize the drug too fast for the drug to do any good, and you shouldn't bother giving them the drug because it won't ever make it to the tissue it needs to. You need to find other drug that works the right way and gives them what they need. Similarly, in diseases like cancer, which are evolutionarily, which is an evolutionary process by which a tumor forms, the genome is different than in the normal DNA, and every one of those cancers that all the different population have a different set of aberrations, and figuring out which tumor needs which treatment has to be done sort of at the level of each individual tumor.
So if we look back in time, when did the concept of gene-level therapy and personalized care emerge in the medical community, and where are we in, you know, from a historic context today with where we want to be in terms of being able to deliver this care to every human on the planet?
The poster child for this personalized medicine is the discovery of Gleevec that Brian Drucker, our Cancer Center director, was critical in developing. And the way Gleevec works is it targets a very particular mutation found in a very particular set of patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia. And so only those patients, for the most part, derive benefit from that drug, or other patients who have a mutation in a gene that the Gleevec drug targets. And so the idea that you can identify those patients who go from having a death sentence in the case of CML to having, you know, 15 years of good life at least is quite remarkable. And so that idea that knowing the change that happened in the genome, predicting the drug you need to treat that change, and then achieving it is quite revolutionary.
I've heard stories about, you know, when you first came out with that drug, that people were actually, you know, entering into their latest stages of cancer hospice care and walked away with a treatment that became more of a chronic issue for them rather than a death sentence, basically.
That's right. So the challenge is that those tumors are completely dependent upon the target of the Gleevec drug, and if you can block its activity, the tumors go away. And there's other challenges that happen later on, but fundamentally, it's targeting the exact cause of the disease and figuring out how to do it. And that's our challenge, not just for CML, but for all the other cancers that we experience.
So OHSU, obviously at the forefront here in terms of medical research, why did you guys decide to partner with Intel, of all people, on advancing medicine?
Well, the process of analyzing genomes is a very complicated one, which is a big challenge and one that we're tackling as part of our collaboration. But we want to actually get deep into the mechanism of how these aberrations work. And for that, we believe we're going to need an enormous computational power and sophisticated analytical approaches that we believe partnering with Intel makes enormous sense. And we're lucky to have Intel join us in this effort.
So when you talk enormous computational power, you're not talking like the folks that want to move up from a PC to a workstation. You really mean enormous when you say enormous. Well, can you put it into context?
I can't put it into great context for you. I mean, so I can tell you that the life sciences are major drivers of the server market. And, you know, my lab, which is a relatively small group, has something on the order of 50 servers. OHSU, we are expanding our staff in the sort of computational biology works life sciences space, but it's not hard to imagine tens of thousands of servers being used productively. And if we can build the kinds of infrastructure that could be shared across the country, you know, hundreds of thousands to millions of servers are not an unreasonable amount of computational power that we could pretty easily deploy and make use of.
It sounds like the challenge really is that scale that you're talking about. How do we take this treatment, which is in its early childhood, and scale it so that it can be applied to the masses? And that's where we may need to do things smarter.
Absolutely. I mean, so the challenge is figuring out what's gone wrong in each individual patient's tumor. And, you know, sometimes it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are examples that go beyond CML. For example, many melanoma patients have very particular mutations that we have now developed drugs for. The drugs aren't quite as durable as we get with CML. The patients tend to recur within 6 to 12 months or something like that. But we know that the tumors all go away for 6 or 12 months and then they all come back. And so we have a challenge of figuring out how to tackle the complexity of the resistance mechanisms that these tumors develop. And that's what we're now in the process of.
You know, it's interesting. I think that when I've talked to my colleagues at Intel who are working on this program, they actually say that we are changing our philosophy and how we're designing the next generation of supercomputers to match the algorithms that you guys need to run to drive efficient genomics analytics. And you know, that's a deeper level of collaboration that I typically see with a particular use case challenge around computing.
Yeah, we have a lot going on in the collaboration, looking thinking about the low-level configuration of both servers, how servers talk to each other, as well as thinking about the future of the chips themselves and which chips need to be put in the servers to achieve the most effective, efficient computation with the best throughput properties and lowest latency for data analysis. And so that is a strong component of the relationship that we're pushing.
So tell me, what is it like to have a bunch of Intel engineers invade your labs? Are they birds of a feather, or is this, you know, two different types of cultures working together? What's it been like to collaborate?
It's a bit of both. My background is in life sciences, but I've always had a strong computer inclination. I was an MIT undergraduate, and so I had lots of roommates who were computer science majors, and I know how they talk, and so that makes it a little easier for me particularly. But we've actually been very, very lucky to get some really smart people who are capable of learning the biology from the Intel side. This is a big challenge, and oftentimes when you talk to computer science folks, and I've done this for now almost 15 years, getting them over the hurdle of what the important questions are is very difficult. And we've been very lucky that our Intel collaborators have actually been incredibly good at this, of being motivated and focused and learning what they need to learn so that we can actually have an intelligent conversation that makes that, that moves us forward. And so we've been meeting roughly 3 times a week. We have Intel staff in my lab at least 2 days a week, and talking to my group and talking to me and figuring out where we can push this forward.
So if you want to cast forward, I know we don't like to make any promises, but if you look in the next few years and you see this collaboration move forward, what is your hope in terms of a great leap forward from what the collaboration will yield for both OHSU and Intel?
So one of the things I'm fundamentally interested in is the idea of crowdsourcing this research. And we got a little bit of view of that in Renee's keynote this morning. But one of the limitations we've traditionally had in academic medicine and medical research is that we do not treat most patients as part of the learning process. They're patients and we treat them and we try to make them better and sometimes we do, but they're not necessarily part of the learning process. And we've been really excited about the idea of expanding the research enterprise to include more and more and more people. And I think this is a great opportunity for the Intel OHSU collaboration to lead a crowdfunded, crowdsourced application to learn from not the few thousands or tens of thousands of patients we see at OHSU, but instead learn from tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of patients around the world with various different diseases. Obviously, my interest is in cancer, but we could do it for lots of different diseases. And so we've been thinking very seriously about the kinds of applications you would need to collect data on, you know, millions of people and mine that data for actual utility.
And when it comes to the broader initiatives that OHSU is driving in terms of cancer, can you give some ideas about the other things that you guys are working on that the audience might find interesting?
There's a lot going on. It's hard to summarize in just a little bit. My lab primarily works on genetics of tumor development and targeted therapies. And so, for example, we're thinking very deeply about tumor evolution and how it varies among individuals. And so we talked a little bit about the genetic differences between tumors, the genetic differences between individuals. We want to know if the genetic differences between individuals constrain or force tumor development in particular ways. And so that's an area we've been pushing into. We want to know whether or not we can make predictions of drugs that need to be treated used together. So we talked about melanoma, a drug called vemurafenib, which is a BRAF inhibitor. Obviously, lots of very technical terms. But we know that if we give that drug, all the tumors go away for a very short amount of time, and then they come back. And we want to make predictions on what drug do we give so they go away and don't come back.
Right.
And so we know we can get rid of them. We just got to keep them gone. And we think combination therapeutics is an approach that might achieve that. So those are two examples of things my lab is working on. We have an enormous initiative that Joe Gray has been leading, and I know you have a chip chat with Joe that people could listen to.
Talking, nice plug. That's good.
Talking about imaging as a data analysis, as a data collection modality. And so Joe's invested millions of dollars in new imaging technologies for OHSU with FEI, which is an electron microscopy company that allows us to create really just absolutely amazing analyses of cell biology at the cell level and the molecular level in ways that, you know, historically I'm not a microscopy guy, I like genetics, but these images are starting to convert me. They're just absolutely incredible to see what the cells are really doing.
That's pretty incredible. That's a little bit far afield from my college biology classes. You know, I think that one of the things that struck me this morning, and this kind of gets to the end game, a third of women and half of men in their lifetimes will be diagnosed with cancer. So, you know, if you're not going to be one of those people, it's likely that one of your family will be touched by this disease, someone in your community.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we look at the end game with personalized medicine, it completely seems to, and I'm validating here, it completely changes the way we treat and address this massive issue for society. Can you give the audience a picture of what you think it will be like from a patient perspective diagnostics and treatment, what is that like in a personalized medicine context versus traditional treatments?
So I think the goal would be that you'd rapidly get an understanding of what's wrong in the disease you have. In the beginning, that may be not necessarily good news. It may be that we know that what you have is really bad and we don't have a way to fix it. That could mean, though, that you're spared lots of really horrible treatments that we give to patients right now. So, you know, my father-in-law passed away after 6 years battling neuroendocrine carcinoma. The first 4 years weren't too bad, but the last couple years were absolutely miserable. And, you know, he was convinced he was going to beat it. You know, he had a very little chance of beating it. We knew that, but he was convinced, and he spent 4 years really fighting hard. And by the end, he was crushed. I mean, he was a shell of what he had used to be, and the last 6 months were really, really hard on everyone. And you know, partly that was from some of the therapies we've been given. Partly it was because he'd been given, you know, he was very sick. But you know, knowing the best you can do for someone actually improves things. So knowing that the drug that we'd normally give you is only going to make you sicker. Now, you know, that's a huge step forward, and so then knowing which patients we need to do something more for is a huge step forward. And so I see it as not giving the wrong treatments to people who aren't going to benefit from them, and then giving better treatments and then getting the best treatments. And so I hope to see it as a evolution from doing okay for lots of patients to doing great for everyone.
Allison, I think we have a question from the audience.
Fantastic.
Hi. So you mentioned in the keynote today, they mentioned things about privacy, and it's personalized medicine. So I was just curious, what kind of privacy issue do you run into with this? Because if it's personal, I have cancer, then I kind of lost that.
It's an excellent question. So we have, you know, some countries have very strict privacy laws. Some have very loose privacy laws. We have sort of somewhere in the middle of the United States, and there are fundamental issues about what people want others to know about them. So, you know, I think that we run into people who volunteer for our clinical trials who are perfectly happy for us to use their picture and their name and tell all about them. And in the keynote today, Renee had Eric Dishman on the stage who freely talks about the disease he's had and what he's done to help to deal with it. Although I'm not sure Eric has actually shared his genome sequence. So some people out there have, and so it's every person, in fact, has their own decision about what's comfortable for them to share. And so, you know, for in medicine, we routinely experience this, that lots of people have things that they want to keep private, and obviously their doctors need to know about it and their nurses need to know about it. And so it's a balance. It's fundamentally a balance between of what you share and how much. And I personally don't think the genomic information is fundamentally different than anything else that's medical information. In fact, by U.S. rules, it's actually less protected, strangely enough, than other personal data. So I can't share your name, but in fact I can share your genome sequence without getting in trouble, without your permission. That said, that most places take it quite seriously and are building rules on how to protect that information. And you know, in the sort of the crowdsourced version of healthcare that I started talking about, we would in fact invite people to choose how much to share. So if they wanted to share everything and put their name on the internet, so be it, and probably a small number of people would. And if they wanted to share everything, use a system to help inform their disease, but not share anything, then we'll encrypt everything. And you know, Intel has chips that are embedded in there to do decryption on the fly, and so you can have very fine grained controls over access, and maybe nothing but the software that runs it would ever see the unencrypted data. So I think there's ways to handle that. It's a social question. But we have the technology to handle most of the technical problems associated with privacy. And it's fundamentally, the challenge is to offer a range of solutions to people so that they can choose something they're comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. I think we've got time for one more question from the audience.
Yeah, I was wondering the partnership that OHSU is doing with Intel, if it will set a framework in cancer genomics that can be applied to other disease areas beyond cancer.
So there's obviously a lot that can go on. We have a major component of our self is our germline DNA. And there are pretty neat initiatives out there where people can assess the risk of developing different diseases based on the DNA you inherited from your parents. And so you might be able to predict that you're at, you know, a fourfold risk of stroke. And the question is, how does that actually change people's behavior? You know, some people, you could tell them they have a fourfold risk of stroke and they keep eating everything they were eating before and maybe double down. And some people might, you know, switch to a vegan diet and, you know, start running 5 miles a day. And so that's a very complicated interaction between variation in the population and what people do about it. But fundamentally, every disease probably has major genetic components that are risk factors for disease, and it's a area that's ripe across research.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for being on today. I think that in the keynotes today, we heard about a very vast range of uses for computing, but I can think of very few that are as compelling in terms of opportunity to improve science for what you guys are doing at OHSU. Thanks for the collaboration, and thanks for being at IDF today on Chip Chat. We will be back at 2:30 p.m. with Intel VP Shannon Pullen, who will be talking about data center innovation. So please come back and tune in for that. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Allison.